Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Judges chapter 3. This chapter will concern the careers of three of the 12 judges, namely Othniel, Ehud, and Shamgar. Our context is this. In the first two chapters of Joshua, we see the 12 tribes' individual conquest of land that had been allotted to them. We see that they failed to drive out all of the Canaanites from their tribal allotments. And then they started disobeying God, started getting into idols, and then God raises up judges, and now we're seeing the judges that are raised up. So we start now in Judges chapter 3, 1 through 4. Now these are the nations which the Lord left to test Israel by them, that is, all who had not experienced any of the wars of Canaan, only in order that the generation of the sons of Israel might be taught war, those who had not experienced it formerly. These nations are the five lords of the Philistines, and all the Canaanites, and the Sidonians, and the Hivites who lived in Mount Lebanon, from Mount Baal Hermon as far as Lebo Hamath. They were for testing Israel to find out if they would obey the commandments of the Lord which he had commanded their fathers through Moses. Now we notice that these tribes are for testing of Israel, but of course if the Israelites had done what they had needed to do, they wouldn't have needed to be tested, they wouldn't have had to fight. They would have had already knocked off all the Canaanites, but they didn't do it, as we saw in the previous two chapters, and so now they were tested. And of course, the application point for that is, if you'll take your lesson full strength early on, it saves a lot of testing and trial later on as God deals with you for you to do what you should have done to start with. Now, in verse 1, it is mentioned that many of those who had not experienced any of the wars of Canaan might be tested. They had not experienced war formally. Who were these people? Well, that would be people who entered the land with Joshua, or at the time that Joshua entered the land, they were either not born, or they were born and too young to remember the wars, or they were born and too young to bear arms at the time. But time has gone past since the death of Joshua, and now people have grown up, and now they are going to be taught war. Now, John Gill has an interesting comment, which I don't agree with. He says, before, the Israelites were not trained in the art of war. They were just supernaturally delivered militarily whenever they had to fight. I don't believe that. I believe that people, you can learn warfare quite well after a few battles or so. Adam Clark adds this comment. He said that arms became a sort of substitute for the spiritual strength that had left the Israelites, and so they needed to be taught war, because they didn't have God supernaturally deliver them. Well, I think both of those are sort of extreme speculations, but the general point is well taken, that the Israelites were not spiritual anymore, and they were fighting their wars on their own now, it seems. So the nations that were left to test that had not been conquered in Joshua's times are mentioned, the five lords of the Philistines. That's the five famous Philistine cities down there in the southwest coastal region of Israel, namely Gaza, Ashkelon, Ashdod, as you go up the coast from the southwest going north, then go inland a little bit, you get to Ekron, and go south from Ekron a little bit, you get to Goliath's stomping grounds, Gath. Now, chapter 1, we saw that Gaza, Ashkelon, and Ekron had been taken from the Philistines by Judah since the death of Joshua, but it didn't take long before the Philistines got them back again, as John Gill says. So by the time we see David fighting the Philistines, all these five cities belong to the Philistines. Now in verse 3, in addition to the five lords of the Philistines, the Canaanites are mentioned as tribes that are left behind in order to test Israel. Now this is the particular tribe of the Canaanites. Sometimes Canaanite is a term that's used to refer to all the pagan tribes in Israel. No, this is the particular Canaanite tribe, the ones that are on the coast of Lebanon, present-day Lebanon, ancient Phoenicia. Later on it was called Phoenicia. These Canaanites, according to John Gill, not only lived on the Mediterranean, they lived further inland on the edge of the Jordan River, too. But basically, I like to think of them as in Lebanon, north of Israel. The Hivites are mentioned in verse 3 as another tribe to test Israel. Easton's Dictionary says that the Hivites were one of the original tribes scattered over Palestine. From Hermon, that's in the northeast, to Gibeon on the south, that's right north of Jerusalem. The Gibeonites, the ones that succored the nation of Israel during the times of Joshua by pretending that all their baggage was old, and so therefore they were a long way away, therefore they were not to be wiped out like the local pagan tribes, and they made a covenant with Joshua's Israel, they were Hivites. And then the Hivites also said to live in Mount Hermon, as we look in Genesis and First Chronicles. The term Hivites means middlers or villagers. They were probably a branch of the Hittites. Easton says they principally inhabit the northern confines of western Palestine. So the Hivites down there near Ai in Benjamin during Joshua's time were not the main concentration of Hivites. But anyway, we go to Baal Hermon, which is mentioned in verse 3. That literally means the Lord of Hermon. That's probably Mount Hermon, the same mountain as Hermon. Easton's dictionary gives two definitions. One definition just says it's a mountain east of Lebanon, the same as Mount Hermon. The other definition says that Baal Hermon is a city near Mount Hermon, probably identical with Baal Gad, if you remember from Joshua's 11:17. I'm sure you don't, but we covered that Baal Gad there. But at any rate, let's just take it as Mount Hermon. And then Lebo Hamath. Now, there's a dispute between the scholars as to whether Lebo Hamath is the same city as Hamath. I've got a map from BibleAtlas.org that has them separated out. You look at the Lebanon and Anti-Lebanon ranges, the valley in between those two ranges. Right at the northern end of that valley, there's the source of the Orontes River, which flows north. And right when you get out of the valley, right at the northern tips of those two mountain ranges, you get to the famous old city of Kadesh, where a very famous ancient battle was fought. Then you go north on the Orontes River and get about halfway, well, maybe a third of the way up its length, you get to Hamath, which some people say is also Lebo Hamath. But now, if you go back to the source of the river, back into the valley between the Lebanon and Anti-Lebanon ranges, right at the very source of the Orontes River on BibleAtlas.org, you will see Lebo Hamath. That's in case it's a separate city. And then the Sidonians are mentioned. Of course, that's on the coast. Those are Canaanites. You go up from Carmel to Acher, then to Tyre, then to Sidon, basically in the land of the Phoenicians, or the Canaanites. All right, enough geography. There we just see some remnants of the Canaanites testing the Israelites. We go to verses 5 and 6 in Judges 3. The sons of Israel lived among the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And they took their daughters for themselves as wives and gave their own daughters to their sons and served their gods. Well, isn't that the way it always is? Application point here. You want to ruin your life? You want to leave God? You want to destroy your life? Let your sons and daughters marry into non-Christian homes. You'll be miserable for the rest of your life. All right, let's look at some more of these ites, starting with the Hittites. Let me read you an interesting quote from Easton's. Palestine and Syria appear to have been originally inhabited by three different tribes. One, the Semites, living on the east of the Isthmus of Suez. That's all the way down there at the border of Egypt and Israel. They were nomadic and pastoral. Then the Phoenicians, who were merchants and traders. Those are the Canaanites that lived up on the coast in present-day Lebanon. That's two. And then three, the Hittites. They were the warlike element of this confederation of tribes. Now, the Hittites are probably some of the most famous of all the ites because they actually had a whole empire, Asia Minor, present-day Turkey. At our time here, they inhabited the whole region between the Euphrates and Damascus, so that's all the way outside of Turkey, all the way into Syria. Their chief cities being Carchemish on the Euphrates, that's the northwestern part of the Euphrates, which is in Syria, and Kadesh, which I just mentioned right there on the Orontes River, in the valley between the Lebanon and Anti-Lebanon range. So all up in that area we just talked about are Hittites. And of course, at one time, for a long time, they were formidable rivals of the Egyptian and Assyrian empires. And the Egyptian and Assyrian empires were the big dogs in the ancient Near East, and the Hittites were up there with them. Now, our time frame here, of course, is somewhere between 1350 and 1050 B.C., and that would cover the tail end of the Hittite empire. And so there were still Hittite tribes floating around. The Amorites were another big dog tribe. Amorites means highlanders or hillmen, the name given to the descendants of one of the sons of Canaan. They showed up in the Assyrian and Egyptian inscriptions that archaeologists have found. They're called the Amura or the Amuri. And in fact, on the early Babylonian monuments, all of Syria, including Palestine, is known as the land of the Amorites. So again, Amorites is not only a particular tribe, it's also a general term to refer to all the pagan tribes that were in Palestine. The southern slopes of the mountains of Judea are called the Mount of Amorites. They seem to have originally occupied the land stretching from the heights west of the Dead Sea to Hebron. They also went even further north, according to some maps, all the way up to the Arkon River on the west side. And, of course, on the east side of the Jordan River, the Amorites, Sihon and Og, you recall all of that, when Moses had to conquer them, they were in the land of Moab and Ammon and all the way up to Bashan on the east side of the Jordan River. So they were a big, big tribe. The Amorites were warlike mountaineers. They're represented on Egyptian monuments with fair skins, light hair, blue eyes, aquiline noses, and pointed beards. In other words, they look like Caucasians instead of Semitic people, so that sort of makes them stand out too. They are supposed to have been men of great stature. Their king, Og, is described by Moses as the last of the remnant of the giants. Also, Og had a big bed that was 13 feet long. I remember that. There's one word of the Amorite language that survives. It's Shinir, the name they gave to Mount Hermon. So the Amorites are interesting people, and so are the Hittites. The Jebusites, of course, are the tribe that held Jerusalem for a long, long time until David finally knocked them all out, drove them out. We won't go through all of that. Joshua had beaten the Jebusites and had beaten their king, but he still didn't manage to drive them all out of Jerusalem. Now, this intermarrying with all these pagan tribes that the Israelites did was a direct violation of the law of God. Deuteronomy 7:3, "Furthermore, you shall not intermarry with them. You shall not give your daughters to their sons, nor shall you take their daughters for your sons." Oh, I'd like to read that to Chinese Christians. They're constantly, the women are constantly marrying pagans because there's not enough Chinese men that are Christians. I don't care what the circumstances are. It is stupid to marry an adulterer. And anybody that doesn't worship Jesus Christ is an adulterer because he's worshiping something, his life, his money, his career, his happiness, his security, whatever, his prosperity, his fame. We go now to Judges chapter 3, verses 7 through 11. "The sons of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and forgot the Lord their God and served the Baals and the Asheroth." Baal is the sun god. The Asheroth is the fertility god. They were headquartered there in Lebanon, in present-day Lebanon in Phoenicia. And, of course, Baals and Asheroth ended up all over the ancient Near East. "Then the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, so that he sold them into the hands of Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Mesopotamia. And the sons of Israel served Cushan-Rishathaim 8 years. When the sons of Israel cried to the Lord raised up a deliverer for the sons of Israel to deliver them, Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother. The Spirit of the Lord came upon him, and he judged Israel. When he went out to war, the Lord gave Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Mesopotamia, into Othniel's hand, so that he, Othniel, prevailed over Cushan-Rishathaim. Then the land had rest 40 years, and Othniel, the son of Kenaz, died. Cushan, the king of Mesopotamia," his name, at least the first part of his name, Cushan means the wicked or the impious, great name. Mesopotamia, of course, is Greek for between the rivers. That's between the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers. This is probably the northern area between the Tigris and the Euphrates, which was Syria, according to John Gill. In fact, Clark says it should be called the Syria of the two rivers. Now, when it says Israel served Cushan-Rishathaim, it means they paid him a heavy tribute, according to Clark. That's the way you serve people. You pay them tribute. Now, when these 8 years started and ended, we don't know. In fact, I'm not going to worry about dates of these judges. Just remember, between 1350 and 1050 B.C. is when the judges operated. Now, this Othniel is actually Caleb's nephew. Caleb had a brother named Kenaz, and Kenaz had a son named Othniel. So Othniel is Caleb's nephew. Now, Caleb had a daughter named Aksah. So Aksah and Othniel were first cousins, and then they got married. We've already seen that actually twice, because Othniel was the guy that conquered Hebron, and Caleb had said, "Whoever conquers these people here..." Well, let me read that to you. Judges 1, verses 12 through 13. Caleb said, "Whoever strikes down and captures Kiriath Sefer," that's also known as Debir, south of Hebron, "I will give my daughter Aksah to him as a wife." So Othniel, son of Kenaz, Caleb's youngest brother, captured it, and Caleb gave his daughter Aksah to him as his wife. So Othniel has already shown himself a man of war. He's captured Kiriath Sefer, Debir. He's captured it already, and that showed his valor. Adam Clark says, apparently attacking Kiriath Sefer, Kiriath Sefer, is how I'm going to pronounce it. Apparently that was a hazardous export, as Adam Clark said, but Othniel did it. And that shows that he was a worthy man for his daughter. And by the way, that's a good application point here, too. If somebody wants to marry your daughter, you better be doggone sure he's not a deadbeat and he will work hard and do well at whatever he does. Now, this 40 years in verse 11, that the land had rest, that could include the 8 years of subjection. So it could be 32 more years, or it could not include the 8 years of subjection that they were subjected to Cushan Rishathaim. We don't know. It doesn't really matter. Now, in verse 11, the narrative matter-of-factly says that Othniel, the son of Kenaz, died. Well, he might have died at the end of that 40 years, or he might have died at the end of the 40 years. If you say he died at the end of the 40 years, that implies that Othniel was keeping peace, and all of a sudden when he died, more trouble broke out. We go now to Judges 3, verses 12 through 14, and we'll see the extent of that trouble. Now the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord. So the Lord strengthened Eglon, the king of Moab, against Israel because they had done evil in the sight of the Lord. Moab, of course, is on the western side of the Dead Sea, basically from the southern tip to the northern tip of the Dead Sea. I meant the eastern side, from the brook Zered all the way up to the city Heshbon. Eglon was in charge of that. He was the king. And the Lord strengthened this pagan king. Why? Because they, the Israelites, had done evil in the sight of the Lord. Application point. Why is China getting so strong today? Could it have something to do with the evil that's going on in America? I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised. And he, that's Eglon, the bad guy, the king of Moab, he gathered to himself the sons of Ammon and Amalek, and he went and defeated Israel, and they possessed the city of the palm trees, that's Jericho. The sons of Israel served Eglon, the king of Moab, 18 years. Now, Eglon means little calf, which is sort of a nice, sweet name for a big, fat king of a pagan country that's oppressing you. Eglon allied himself with the Ammonites. If you go from the north, roughly now, from the north of the tip of the Dead Sea on the eastern side and go all the way up to the Jabbok River, which is roughly halfway up the Jordan Valley, that's Ammon. Now, Easton says that Ammon is another form of the name Ben-Ammi. Ben-Ammi was the son of Lot. And if you recall, he was born because Lot's daughter had incestuous sexual relations with her father, which has always been pretty disgusting to me. And there the name is sitting right there for all of us. Thousands of years later, over 3,000 years later, we can still remember Ammon. In fact, the capital city of Jordan today, which is present-day Jordan, is Ammon. It reminds us all of the incest that gave rise to this city, this country of Ammon. And Ammon, of course, was a natural ally of Eglon because it was north of Moab. Now, Amalek were the southern neighbors of Moab. Ammon were the northern neighbors of Moab. Amalek was a tribe that dwelt in Arabia Petraea, and that's the old-fashioned way of dividing the Arabian desert up. The easiest way to remember Arabia Petraea is between the dead and the red, between the Dead Sea and the Red Sea. The Red Sea, of course, is the Gulf of Aqaba down there, and the Gulf of Suez, which is the northern extremities of the Sinai Peninsula. Now, Amalek, according to Easton's, was probably a tribe that migrated from the shores of the Persian Gulf and settled in Arabia. They settled in the land of the south, according to Numbers 13:29, from Havilah until thou comest to Shur. Now, Shur is the desert that separates Egypt. The northeastern part of Egypt is called Goshen. You go a little bit further east around the southern coast of the Mediterranean Sea, and you're in another desert called Shur, and the Wadi El Arish runs right through Shur, and that's the dividing line between Egypt and Israel. And so this is where the Amalekites were. They were a pastoral and hence a nomadic race. Their kings bore the hereditary name of Agag. They attempted to stop the Israelites when they marched through their territory, attacking them at Rephidim. That was in the first year of the Exodus, actually, right before they got to Mount Sinai. That was the famous battle where Joshua fought, and Moses stands up on a mountain holding his arms up, and whenever he held his arms up, Joshua won. When he let his arms down, Joshua lost. Now, the Amalekites afterwards attacked the Israelites at Hormah, which means destruction, I think, if I remember correctly. We read of them subsequently as in league with the Moabites. That's where we are now in Judges 3. And later on, we're going to see the Amalekites in league with the Midianites in Judges 6. Saul finally desolated their territory. Saul began ruling in 1050, quit, or 1052, depending, and then he died in 1010 B.C. Saul finally desolated the Amalekites and destroyed their power. David recovered booty from them. In the Babylonian inscriptions, they are called Sut, S-U-T-E. In those of Egypt, Sitiu. And the Amarna tablets include them under the general name of Kabati, which means plunderer. So these guys were bad dudes. I mean, God was always after the Amalekites. Anytime they're mentioned, is God, destroy these guys. Even the Egyptians called them plunderers. And I mentioned these occasions of their name showing up on the ancient archaeological documents because it just gives you a better feel for the historicity of the Old Testament, in case you were doubting it because you've been influenced by some dead-headed liberal theologian who hates the Bible. Now, in verse 13, it says that Eglon, king of Moab, defeated Israel. Now, that's probably the 2.5 tribes on the east side of the Jordan where Eglon was. And then he crossed over the Jordan River to capture Jericho, because Eglon hasn't had a chance really to defeat Israel all on the west side of the Jordan. Now, when it says he captured the city of the palm trees, that's not the actual city, probably. That had been destroyed not too long previously by Joshua, but it probably refers to the country around it, or maybe even a city near the site of Jericho that had been rebuilt. We move now to Judges 3, verses 15 through 19. But when the sons of Israel cried to the Lord raised up a deliverer for them. And to me, that's the best translation for a judge, is a deliverer. Ehud, the son of Gera, the Benjamite, a left-handed man. And you say, well, why? So what if he's left-handed? Well, we'll see later in the story. It makes a big deal. It is a big deal why he was left-handed. And the sons of Israel sent tribute by him to Eglon, the king of Moab. Ehud made himself a sword which had two edges, a cubit in length, that's 18 inches, and he bound it on his right thigh under his cloak. He presented the tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. Now, Eglon was a very fat man. It came about when he had finished presenting the tribute that he sent away the people who had carried the tribute. That's the he there is talking about Ehud. By the way, it's easy to confuse Ehud and Eglon. Remember, Ehud is the Benjamite, the good guy, and Eglon is the Moabite, the bad guy. It came about when he, Ehud, had finished presenting the tribute that he, Ehud, sent away the people who had carried the tribute. In other words, Ehud's attendants. He sent them away. But he himself turned back from the idols which were at Gilgal and said, I have a secret message for you, O king. And he said, keep silence. And all who attended him left him. Now, Ehud means love or pleasant or united. Actually, there's two Hebrew words translated Ehud. And so there's a little bit of confusion over this, but just roughly, love, pleasant, or united. It's a nice name. He's the son of Gera. Gera is otherwise unknown. Ehud is a Benjamite, and of course, Jericho is in the tribe of Benjamin. And so it's logical that a local deliverer would be raised up to take the city back and to defeat the Moabites. Now, the fact that he was left-handed is ironic because Benjamite means, it signifies a son of the right hand being the hand of authority. So here we have a son of the right hand who was left-handed, and it makes a big difference that he's left-handed, as we'll see in a minute. Now, in verse 15, it says, the sons of Israel sent tribute to Eglon. Now, that could just be a general statement talking about the 18 years that they were having to send tribute. That could just be a summary statement of that. Or it could be referring to the tribute that was going to Eglon right now at the time of the story. Well, if it was, they probably didn't know what Ehud was up to. I think we can deduce that or infer that from the facts here. Ehud would probably not want them to know anyway, because things leak, and if he's contemplating a private assassination of a foreign king, that's a big deal. You want to be as secret as you can. So they probably didn't know. In fact, the people that were carrying the tribute, he sent them away before he carried out his assassination. Now, it sounds like in verse 19, they were at the idols at Gilgal. And idols, there's a translation issue there. It might mean stone quarries. But either way, the idols are the stone quarries which are at Gilgal. Now, the exact sequence, the chronological sequence of events here is not clear. The way I take it is that they had seen Eglon in Moab, not at Gilgal, Gilgal being on the west side of the Jordan River. That's where Joshua first crossed over. They weren't there. The tribute carriers, Ehud and his attendants, had gone east of the Jordan River, gone to wherever Eglon was in Moab, given him the tribute, and then they left and went back, crossed back over the Jordan River, got all the way to Gilgal, which is not too far across, going to the west across the Jordan River. And then when he was there, Ehud told his attendants, "You go back home. You go back home." Why did he do that? You notice he sent him away. He didn't say, "I'm going back to Moab to give a secret message to Moab, to Eglon. He just sent him away. Why? Well, I'm assuming here, again, that this is in Gilgal, whereas Eglon is over in Moab. So Eglon doesn't know that this is happening. He doesn't know that all the tribute people are being sent away. But why did he send them away? Well, by doing that, there was less chance that his servants, his attendants, might betray his secret. I mean, let's face it. As soon as they left, they could turn back around and say, "Where are you going? Where are you going, Ehud? Oh, you're going back toward Moab? Why are you doing that?" It looks suspicious. It would look suspicious. So he just sent them away, and he did it far enough away. He was at Gilgal, so when the attendants saw Ehud turning back toward Moab, they couldn't tell anybody because they were too far away from Moab. Also, by sending the attendants away early like this, or sending them away so that they wouldn't participate in the assassination attempt, Ehud now does not have to worry about the safety of his servants. Now in verse 16, Ehud made himself a sword which had two edges. Two edges is good for stabbing people. Double-edged sword. He strapped it to his right thigh. That's because it's easier if you're left-handed to grab a sword across your body at the right thigh and to draw it quickly and to use it. It's much harder to draw from your same side. And so that's why these left-handed and right-handed actions are specifically related to us. And by the way, as I'll point out later, most people who are defending against drawn swords, they're going to assume that the person is right-handed because most people are right-handed. But if the person is left-handed, a lefty, oh my gosh, they're not as ready for it. Now, the fact that Eglon was very fat, that little detail is necessary too. Right here, it's necessary to show that it would make it hard for Eglon to parry the sword thrust. Now, at verse 19, the place where Ehud sent his attendants away so he could be alone to carry out his assassination, that could have been a place that Eglon had deliberately set up idols to provoke Israel. These are speculations here. I'm assuming this is the same Gilgal. There's several different Gilgals, but I'm assuming this is the same Gilgal that Joshua camped at when they first crossed the Jordan River after Moses had died on the east and they went west across the Jordan. Joshua 5:3, Gilgal means rolling away. They rolled away their reproach by being circumcised. Joshua 5:3, so Joshua made himself flint knives and circumcised the sons of Israel at Gibeath Haraloth, which means hill of foreskins. So this was kind of a holy place for the Israelites. And not only that, the ark had been there for some time before it was moved to Shiloh. And so Eglon might have said, "Well, the holy place of Israel, let's put some idols there, because we understand that these Israelites don't like idols. And their God Yahweh is a jealous God. Well, we're going to make him jealous. We're going to put some idols up." Now, that's an interesting speculation. It very well could be. Some speculate that the idols came from the 12 stones that were set up in the Jordan when Israel entered. Remember that in Joshua 4:20, those 12 stones which they had taken from the Jordan, Joshua set up at Gilgal. And so I guess the speculation is Eglon could have taken those 12 stones and somehow made an idol out of them. That's a reasonable speculation. It's interesting speculation. And we need to remember the word might not even mean idol. It might mean stone quarry. But if it does mean idol, and if Eglon had put those idols there, that was a public affront to Israel. That was disgusting. And so Ehud's going to do something about it. Now, this is what Cambridge says about the sequence of events here. Quote, "Ehud waited at the sanctuary to find a pretext for returning unexpectedly to speak with the king. He had received an oracle there." That's at Gilgal. "A message from God, which he must communicate to the king personally." Now, Cambridge is assuming that the tabernacle was still at Gilgal. I don't know why he would say that, because they've already moved in the end of Joshua. They had moved the tabernacle to Shiloh. Maybe even they had moved it even further north to Shechem. I don't think it's clear. And now I'm trying to think I'm trying to remember, did they actually move the tabernacle to Shiloh, or is that a speculation of one of my commentators? I can't remember. I think you can go back to Joshua and see that it was actually moved to Shiloh. And if that's so, well, what's it doing back here down at Gilgal? I don't know. All of this is speculation. And of course, the way you read the text, it sounds like Eglon is at Gilgal, which he could have been because he had a lot of Moabite soldiers occupying the land of Israel. He could have been at Gilgal. But I don't think so. I think he's back at Moab. There's nothing in this verse that says that Eglon was at Gilgal. It just is an inference. We go now to Judges 3, verses 20 through 22. Ehud came to him while he was sitting alone in his cool roof chamber. And Ehud said, I have a message from God for you. And he arose from his seat. That would be Eglon arose from his seat. Ehud stretched out his left hand, took the sword from his right thigh, and thrust it into his, i.e., Eglon's belly. The handle also went in after the blade, and the fat closed over the blade. For he, that's Ehud, did not draw the sword out of his, Eglon's belly, and the refuse came out. Now Eglon's cooling his heels in his roof chamber. The houses back then were flat, and the roof chamber was a lot smaller and more private than his audience room, which would have been below, kind of a big open space in the middle of the house, a gallery, if you will, open space with rooms on the first floor opening up into that gallery, and that would be public stuff going on there. So he's up in his private chamber, and these private chambers, of course, would have stairs that goes down into the gallery inside the house or on the outside to the street. And these rooms could be used to entertain guests privately, entirely secluded from the noise of the house. So that's where he was. Now, Ehud returns and says, hey, King Moab, I've got a message from God for you. Well, the message was somewhat harsh. It was an assassination. And now we turn to an ethical problem. I love ethical problems in the Old Testament. Here's the problem. Is it ethical to assassinate princes? Now remember, Ehud was not acting as a private citizen. He was an agent of Israel. And so the prima facie argument is that our solution to this question is that was ethical. This was an act of war. This was not an act of private revenge. And also, many people say Ehud was directed by the Spirit of God to do this. Well, as Adam Clark is going to point out here in a minute, it never says that Ehud was directed by the Spirit of God. That is an inference. So, I mean, if it said that Ehud did it by the Spirit of God, there would be no ethical problem. We know that it was perfectly all right. So let me read you Clark's emotional defense of the case that Ehud was a murderer. A murderer. One of the judges of Israel was a murderer. This is Adam Clark. Quote, and by the way, I disagree with him entirely. Quote, the case of Ehud killing Eglon is a very serious one, and how far he was justified in this action is with all a question of importance, and with not a few a question of difficulty. It's not a question of difficulty with me. I don't have any problem with it at all. But some people do, and Adam Clark did. Is it right to slay a tyrant? Aye, says Adam Clark, without hesitation answer, no individual has a right to slay any man, except it be in his own defense, when a person attacks him in order to take away his life. But may not any of his oppressed subjects put an end to the life of a tyrant? No. The state alone can judge whether a king is ruling contrary to the laws and constitution of that state. The state alone? What happens if the state? That the king is the state. If he's ruling contrary to the laws, and you ask the king to judge whether the king is acting contrary to the laws, what kind of an objective judgment are you going to have about that? Well, let me finish with what Adam Clark says. And if that state have provided laws for the punishment of a ruler who is endeavoring to destroy or subvert that constitution, then let him be dealt with according to those laws. Well, that's a big if, folks. Big if, Adam Clark. What about Adolf Hitler? He had a state. He was a ruler. He was actually doing some very horrible stuff. Well, we can't assassinate Hitler because the state is designed to take care of Hitler. Yeah, really? The Nazi state's going to take care of Hitler. Of course, Clark wrote before Hitler. He might have changed his tune if he had seen what can happen. But no, Clark continues, but no individual or number of individuals in that state has any right to dispose of the life of the ruler but according to law. Really? Tell that to Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the ex-pacifist who tried to assassinate Hitler. He unfortunately failed. Wish he had succeeded. To take his life in any other way is no less than murder. It is true God, the author of life and the judge of all men, may commission one man to take away the life of a tyrant. But the pretension to such a commission must be strong, clear, and unequivocal. In short, if a man think he have such a commission, to be safe, he should require the Lord to give him as full an evidence of it as he did to Moses. And when such a person comes to the people, in other words, that person should have a direct face-to-face conversation with God. Should I go kill Adolf Hitler or not? And when such a person comes to the people, they should require him to give as many proofs of his divine call as the Hebrews did Moses before they should credit his pretensions. So Dietrich Bonhoeffer should have gone to the German people and says, God appeared to me in a dream, says kill Adolf, to cure Hitler. Really? But had not he heard a divine call? Continues Clark, I cannot tell. If he had, he did not murder Eglon. If he had not, his act, however, it succeeded, was a murderous act. And if he had no message from God, and there is no proof that he had, then he was a most base and hypocritical assassin. The sacred historian says nothing of his motives nor call. He mentions simply the fact and leaves it without either observation or comment, and every reader is left to draw his own inference. Well, I've drawn my own inference. It seems to me that Clark is overlooking something. Ehud didn't assassinate one of his own government leaders. This was not an act of treason. This was an act of war. Eglon was a sworn practicing enemy of Israel, and Israel didn't really have a government. It was a loose government at the time, but Ehud was acting in the name of Israel, and so he wiped out a man who was the king of a country that was grinding the Israelites' nose in the dirt. Well, enough of that. It says here in verse 20 that Eglon arose from his seat. He probably arose because when he heard that Ehud had a message from God, he probably stood up and says, whoa, come on in, I'd like to hear that. Or maybe he was just being polite. I don't know, he's a king. Usually kings don't stand up, but I think he was trying to stand up so he could hear what this message was. And that, of course, was a bad mistake because it made it easier for Ehud to stab him. He was probably overjoyed that he was about to hear a dream from God. Instead of hearing a message from God, he got a knife in the gut. Minor point here, the word, a message from God, that's not Yahweh. It could be translated, I have a message from the gods for you. But I don't think so. I don't think that a Israelite would say something like that. If he did, then Ehud would be pretending to bring a message from the idols, thinking that maybe Eglon would appreciate a message from idols more than he would appreciate a message from Yahweh, but I don't think so. The handle in verse 22 goes all the way into the fat of Eglon's belly and disappears. That shows the violence of Ehud's thrust. He had to push 18 inches of blade all the way into the fat and keep on going until the blade disappeared. Eglon did not even manage a yell to get help. It was such a sudden thing, and he was probably dead pretty quick. Says he did not yell out. Verse 22 says that Ehud did not draw the sword out of Eglon's belly. KV just says he could not withdraw the knife from Eglon's belly, and that translation would mean that Ehud unwillingly left the knife in Eglon. He lost his knife, in other words. I don't know. Minor point, and this is another minor point, but I don't know why the author of Judges put this in here. The refuse came out. God, that's disgusting. Blood, excrement, guts. But since we're on a disgusting topic here, let's see what John Gill says about this. Here's some options as to what it means that the refuse came out of the wound. It could be that excrement came out of the wound because, after all, the blade could have hit Eglon's intestines. John Gill says, nah, there's no excrement coming out of the wound because the wound was closed up with the fat. And so the excrement wouldn't come out of that wound. I don't know about that. It could seep through. John Gill prefers to think that the excrement came out through Eglon's anus because people dying a violent death often purge that way. Huh, wonderful. I don't know what this has to do with anybody's spiritual edification, but the author of Judges put it in there, so we're going to comment on it. We go now to Judges chapter 3, verses 23 through 25. Then Ehud went out into the vestibule and shut the doors of the roof chamber behind him and locked them. When he had gone out, his servants came and looked, and behold, the doors, that's Eglon's servants. When he, Ehud, had gone out, Eglon's servants came and looked, and behold, the doors of the roof chamber were locked. And they, the servants, said, He is only relieving himself. He, Eglon, is only relieving himself in the cool room. They waited until they became anxious, but behold, he did not open the doors of the roof chamber. Therefore they took the key and opened them, and behold, their master had fallen to the floor dead. So now we turn to the story of Ehud's escape, which is kind of interesting. He first went out into the vestibule. Now the vestibule, that word means a entrance compartment, a little tiny room before another bigger room. But then Avi Margin says the meaning of the Hebrew word is uncertain. But let's assume that's true. He went out. He shut the doors of the roof chamber behind them and locked them. He locked them from the outside, which means he had to have had a key. He probably got the key while he was inside the room. After he killed Ehud, he found the key and went and locked the door. Now, when the servants came back, they found the door locked, and they had their own keys, and they let themselves back in. Now, notice the time that has passed. They waited, and they waited, and they waited, because they figured, well, the king's locked himself in because he's taking a leak. He's relieving himself, and they didn't want to break in on the king while he's taking a leak. But when they finally did get in, they found Eglon lying on the floor. Now, at first, they might have thought he was unconscious, and they might have turned him over and said, is he conscious? Is he living? This is taking time. Now, all of which time Ehud is using to get out of Dodge. Now, remember, the knife wound would not be immediately obvious because it would be covered up with fat. However, the refuse had come out, and so they would see that, and that might tend to make them think there's something bad wrong here. But at any rate, Ehud escapes. Now, this is what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say about that escape. Quote, the whole circumstance of this daring act, the death of Eglon without a shriek or noise, the locking of the doors, the carrying off the key, the calm, unhurried deportment of Ehud, show the strength of his confidence that he was doing God's service. So Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown doesn't think, like Adam Clark does, that Ehud was a terrible murderer. One little minor point here, the reason that the servants found the doors locked, or what they might have thought when they found the doors locked, they must have figured, well, Eglon's locked himself in to be private so he could go to the bathroom. We go now to Judges 3, verses 26 through 27. Now Ehud escaped while they were delaying, and he, Ehud, passed by the idols, or the stone quarries, that would be at Gilgal, and he escaped to Sarah. Sarah is another name for Bethel, about 10 miles north of Jerusalem. Bethel is about 10 miles northwest of Bethel. It's all in the same general area there in the tribe of Benjamin. Verse 27, it came about when he, Ehud, had arrived at Bethel, at Sarah, that he blew the trumpet in the hill country of Ephraim, and the sons of Israel went down with him from the hill country, and he was in front of them. Hill country of Ephraim is just the name of the mountain of the hill, the range of hills that ran north from Benjamin up into the tribe of Ephraim. Now it says, now Ehud escaped while they were delaying. I've already mentioned some of this delay. Well, let's look at some of the delay. The servants delayed, waiting to open Eglon's door, wanted to give him some time to go to the bathroom. Then they were in confusion after finding Eglon dead. They might have thought that Eglon had accidentally fallen, in which case there wouldn't be anybody to chase because there would be no murder. It's just that somebody fell. They may have called some doctors, some physicians, to check out Eglon. Is he really dead, or how did he die? What made him die? Because remember, Eglon didn't yell at anything, and there was no way for them to know that there had been an assassination attempt. Now, Sarah, which I said was Bethel, this is according to BibleAtlas.org. Easton says that the word Sarah means woody district, or shaggy. It was a place among the mountains of Ephraim, bordering on Benjamin, the northern part of Benjamin, in other words. This district had probably suffered more from the grievous oppression of the Moabites, probably because they were close to the fords there at Gilgal, as the Moabites would cross the Jordan River there, and that's where they ended up, right there in Benjamin. Now in verse 27, we have Ehud blowing a trumpet. That's a call to arms. Here's what Gil says about that, quote, which being an high mountain, the sound of the trumpet was heard afar off, and if Ehud's design was known to the Israelites, what he intended to do, this might be the token agreed on, and should he succeed, to call them together. In other words, they might have made previous arrangements. If you hear the trumpet, come join me in battle. We go now to Judges 3, verses 28 through 30. He, that's Ehud, said to them, that's the sons of Israel who had responded to the trumpet, Ehud said to them, "Pursue them, pursue the Moabites, for the Lord has given your enemies, the Moabites, into your hands." So they went down after him and seized the fords of the Jordan opposite Moab, and did not allow anyone to cross. They, that's the sons of Israel, struck down at that time about 10,000 Moabites, all robust and valiant men. That's the Moabites, were all robust and valiant men, and no one escaped. So Moab was subdued that day under the hand of Israel, and the land was undisturbed for 80 years. Now Ehud's probably very excited when he blew that trumpet. He said, "Go, go, go, go get the Moabites. The Lord has given your enemies into your hands." Ehud probably figures that Moab is in great confusion now because the king has been killed, so he's confident. "We're going to beat them now. They don't have a leader." Notice that the sons of Israel went down after Ehud in verse 28. That means Ehud is leading them. He took the lead and he took the risk of being killed. That's what leaders do. They take the heat. They went down to the fords of the Jordan. Now, right at the north of the Dead Sea, right before the Jordan River enters into the Dead Sea, there's fords that cross over into Moab. And the Israelites took control of those fords, and that's so they could bottle up the 10,000 Moabites that were in the land. Those Moabites were probably garrisoned there to subject the Israelites to the Moabite rule, to collect tribute from them and so forth. And so the Moabites, when they realized that they were in a heap of trouble, they would probably try to flee east across the Jordan River. But when they got there, they couldn't cross because the Israelites controlled the fords. And so they were trapped. And so then they got killed. 10,000 of them were struck down, it says in verse 29. Those Moabites were left in Israel, according to John Gill, to keep Israel in subjection. Perhaps some of them settled in Israel for profit so they could do business there, or maybe both soldiers to subject and business Moabite businessmen to make money. But at any rate, they were toast. Now notice it says that the Moabites were robust and valiant men. That's probably because the subjugating troops were hand-picked by Eglon. Now in verse 30 it says Moab was subdued. That probably is not referring to the land of Moab. The Israelites probably didn't cross back over to the east to get Moab. It's referring to the Moabites who are within Israel. As Adam Clark says, John Gill says that, and Adam Clark further says, quote, "It is very likely that the Moabites, who were on the western side of Jordan, hearing of the death of Eglon, were panic-struck and endeavored to escape over Jordan at the fords near Jericho when Ehud blew his trumpet in the mountains of Ephraim, and thus to get into the land of the Moabites, which lay on the east of Jordan. But Ehud and his men, seizing the only pass by which they could make their escape, slew 10,000 of them in their attempt to cross at these fords." So Moab is subdued. The land was undisturbed for 80 years. Now, let's look further at this word undisturbed. Here's what John Gill says. "There were several judges at a time in several parts of the land, and that the land was at rest in one part when there was war in another, so that at this time it was only the eastern part of the land that had rest for 80 years, while the western parts were distressed by the Philistines and the northern parts by Jabin, king of Canaan," which we'll see in future chapters of Judges. And I think that makes sense. It means the eastern part of Jordan was undisturbed for 80 years because the Israelites had plenty of trouble with other pagan tribes within an 80-year period, I would think. Now that 80 years, again, it might include the 18 years of subjection to the Moabites. So you got 18 years of subjection plus 62 years of rest. I think it most probably means 80 years of rest after the 18-year subjection. The 80 years is usually dated from Othniel's deliverance, but dating the judges is a job for Old Testament PhDs. There's not enough evidence here to say when what judge started and what judge ended. So again, 1350 to 1050, that's the time of the judges. That's close enough. We go now to Judges 3, verse 31. "After him," that's after Ehud, "came Shamgar." So this is our third judge, Shamgar. First judge was Othniel. The second judge was Ehud. And now the third judge here is Shamgar, the son of Anath, who struck down 600 Philistines with an ox goad, and he also saved Israel. Shamgar means sword. According to babynames.com, I sure hope I can trust that website, but it's the fastest website to find out what a name means. Now the Philistines had probably come into the land of Israel as bandits and robbers during the times of the judges. We read in Judges 5:6, "In the days of Shamgar, the son of Anath, in the days of Jael, The highways were deserted, and travelers went by roundabout ways. Robbers, bandits. Now Shamgar killed 600 Philistines. That could have been in one big battle, which is pretty rough to think that one man could kill 600 Philistines at one time. It could mean, and most probably means, at different times he killed Philistines. Now, if we want to take the option that he killed all 600 at one time, I think about Sergeant York. Remember, he went up to a German line and he enfiladed it. He performed raking fire lengthwise along the file of the German soldiers. I shouldn't say the file, this is the rank, actually, along the length. Let's just say, put it this way, along the length of the soldiers he shot. And so as they turned toward the gunfire, they couldn't get at Sergeant York because people were in front of him. So York picked them off one at a time. Well, likewise, it could be that Shamgar did the same thing with the Philistines. They were all lined up somewhere. He sneaks up, gets them on, he flanks them. He's on their flank, and he starts banging them one at a time lengthwise. And so they couldn't rush him, especially if they're on the defile of a mountain or someplace like that. I remember first reading that and thinking, oh, that's hard for me to believe, killing 600 Philistines. I don't have any trouble with that. Two reasons. He could have enfiladed them, or two, he could have done it all at different times. So, ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Judges chapter 3, verses 31. We are now prepared to go to Judges chapter 4, verses 1 through 24, and we will look at the famous story of Deborah and Barak. See you next time. Hope you enjoyed this audio.